Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And we're going to be doing a show on universality. Maybe that's one way to look at it. We're going to take in the entire, maybe even more than the universe, in this show. We're going to be looking at spirituality and mysticism with a man who I'm in great awe of. And I use the word awe consciously, and he'll understand why, and you'll understand why later. But this guest is somebody who has written many, many, many books, and I'm going to talk about his 28th book called Christian Mystics. And I'm speaking with Matthew Fox. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hello, Peter. Good morning. Thank you.
I'm so glad you could join us, because you're doing such important work in the world, and the more exposure you have, the healthier it is for this planet.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, I'm so impressed with this book, Christian Mystics, because it's you walking your talk. You're a renowned heretic. And so what is it about this book that, I mean, it's understandable when people know that you're such a mover and shaker of mind and godliness even. And what brought you to this book?
Well, of course, I've been trying to recover the Western mystical tradition for 40 years, working with giants like Meister Eckhart, Hildegard of Bingen, Thomas Aquinas, whose mystical teachings have really been covered up by an awful lot of churchiness. But I just feel that Christianity, now all our religions, have to simplify themselves. They have to be shaken down and shake themselves down. We can't go into the 21st century with the burdens of 2,000 years of religious Christianity, with all this institutionalism and laws on our backs. We have to provide for the younger generation a clearer and more authentic naming of the Christ experience and of the Jesus story and his teachings. And the latest scholarship, like John's recent book on St. Paul, and in it he says that for Paul, who of course is the first writer in the Christian Bible, you cannot be a Christian without being a mystic. And my experience is that so many Christians are mystically illiterate. They have not been taught the mystics. They don't teach it in the seminaries for the most part. And we need to get down to what the essence of religion is. Carl Jung says that it's the mystics who bring out what is the best in religion. And I just want to shake our tradition up and get down to what really matters. This is what's worth saving.
Well, I want to change a word that you said that I don't agree with, actually. I don't think it simplifies it. I think actually we're taking the simplification away, and we're adding the much deeper values that you can go on and on and on in great depth about.
Sure. Well, what we mean by simple, and there is a depth to authentic simplicity, but you're right, there's a simplistic religion that's out there that is what I'm battling with, which is about slogans and projections, really, people projecting onto Christ or God and not doing the inner work of self-evaluation and of introspection and of purifying our intentions and so forth. So, yeah, by simple, I don't mean simplistic, but I do mean that the message of Jesus and of Buddha and of Muhammad and of others is not... It doesn't take a PhD in religion to know what they're saying. They're saying, you know, to be honest with yourself and to be compassionate to yourself and to others, and to love others the way you love yourself, and to put this into action in your culture in terms of work for justice and fairness.
And that's understandable in what we know about the way that Jesus led his life. It's just that these religions took over afterwards that put very artificial stamps on it.
Well, that's very true, and that so often happens. And like Father B. Griffith, who was a very real mystic and a very beautiful human being. He was a Benedictine monk who lived in India for over 50 years and had an ashram there for Hindus and Christians. And he says that every religion begins with a mystical experience. Jesus was a mystic, Buddha was a mystic, and so forth. But then it has to develop a language to tell the insights and the new perspectives. But as soon as you start developing the language, and then institutions, and then schools, and then seminaries, and so forth and so forth, you wander. You can wander very, very far from that original inspiration. And that's really, I think, the time we're living in. Certainly as a Christian, I have to be criticizing the church after 2,000 years and ask the question, can't we do better? Can't we present the basic and really radical message of Jesus in a more direct fashion and with less overhead?
Well, it's also about God, too, and this is a question that I'm asked a lot by people. I've actually in New York, I have a religious corporation called Heart River Center, and it's, I don't call it a religion.
Uh-huh.
It's a spiritual center, and mm-hmm. and people ask me, do I believe in God?
Uh-huh.
And my first response is, well, that all depends. You know, why? What are you asking, actually?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I say that all depends, they say, oh, then you don't believe in God.
Oh, well, I think one thing you're asking is, well, what do you mean by God? What kind of God do you believe in? I mean, many people believe that they don't call it that, but the truth is we believe in the God of consumerism and the God of greed. I mean, you're in New York. You must know something about Wall Street.
Right.
And the God of power. I mean, we have many gods, and that's the whole point about critiquing. I mean, that's the Jewish tradition about idolatry, that we have to critique our projections. And that's, you know, I think how certainly Jung and contemporary psychology talk about the projections we make on God. And that's where the mystics are so valuable. Like Meister Eckhart says, all the names you give to God come from an understanding of ourselves. So we have to be very careful what we're projecting on God. For an example would be, is a God you believe in an entirely male God? Obviously, the God of Cardinal Ratzinger, the present Pope, is an entirely male God. And that's very dangerous, because then that means that only the male energy is held up as something sacred, and the feminine energy is reduced to second class. So it's a God you believe in as much feminine as masculine. And if it's, and of course, regarding the masculine, what do we mean by that? What has our culture taught us about masculinity, and is that healthy or is it toxic? My previous book was on the sacred masculine, they call it the hidden spirituality of men. And this whole thing of cleaning up our gender projections and our gender understanding is a very important thing to do at this time in history, because our species is running out of time. We have to find a new balance in the yin and the yang, the masculine and the feminine, and the god and the goddess, and time's running out.
And it's interesting that in the Middle East now there's such upheaval, and a lot of it is to give the women more rights.
I hope so. I really hope so. And a lot of it is the youth, you see. You know, in these Arab countries, I think the average age is something like 18 or something. Cause it's a very young culture, a lot of young people. And, of course, they're not being promised jobs. A lot of them are not even getting education. And they definitely have a right to be revolting. And of course, all the young people are all around the world are inheriting a depleted and a sick, literally sick planet. You know, most of the fisheries of the ocean are fished out at this time. And so the world that the young people are facing is a very, very different world. It's no longer as healthy as it was. And so there are a lot of changes that have to take place, including in education. We have to reinvent education. It's been a big part of my life the last 30 years.
Well, in the last century, we lived in a material truth. And what you're helping to usher in is a spiritual truth and a deeper understanding of why we are who we are, which is to experience that deeper place in our own selves and each other.
Well, that's right. And we really have to begin there with what really matters, the what we really cherish, what is it we really love, and what really springs awe alive in us, and with it gratitude and reverence. And then to go deeply into our grief, into the darkness. What is it we are really grieving? And if we don't pay attention to grief and have rituals to help us through grief, then we're stuck at the level of anger, because the first level of grief is anger, and there is of course a lot of anger in the world today, especially among young people. And then the third depth, I think, of our beings is our creativity. And this is of course the great gift that humans bring to the world, that we are so creative. But the problem is that we can use our creativity for good or for ill. I mean, inventing gas ovens and inventing nuclear submarines is one use of creativity, but also creating good work and creating rituals that heal and celebrate and bring joy alive for community. That's another form of creativity, and we're lagging behind in that regard. Most of our religious worship today is boring, and it doesn't include the body, and it doesn't include the lower chakras that connect us to the earth, and that will help us to recover a sense of the sacredness of the earth and reverence for the earth.
Well, one thing that you represent to me, in not only in this book, but in knowing and seeing your other work, I've gone online and I've seen some talks you've given, and what you're out there doing, and to me, what you're bringing is not only more meaning, but passion.
Mm.
You know, you're somebody who's had to break the bonds that you were earlier born into, and you were a Dominican priest?
Yes, I was I was a Dominican for 34 years. Mm-hmm.
And so
the Pope fired me.
Right, exactly. But that's the point, is that it took the passion for you to believe in what you know and who you are, to not be burdened by a Pope firing you.
Well, yeah, and of course, compassion is a kind of passion. It's passion with. And I like how you talk about the need for passion, because what's the opposite of passion? It's couch potato-itis. It's, you know, sitting in front of TV and letting others run our lives for us. And, you know, that's no way to be a citizen in a democracy. And it's certainly no way to heal the earth today. All of us have to get out of our couches and become the spiritual warriors that every one of us is capable of being. And that means carrying on struggles for justice and healing for the earth, for unemployed, for women if they're oppressed, for gays and lesbians if they're oppressed. You know, there's work for everybody. There's plenty of work to do.
But
have fun doing it.
Yeah, but exactly. That's what I wanted to interject here, is that it's not that it doesn't have to be a dark experience. There, what is something that you're teaching is our inner godliness of our inner truth and our inner purpose. And so when you get hold of that, there's such a feeling of perfection of who we are in terms of being true to ourselves that we have no choice but to live it out.
Well put. Well put. Yes, there's a nobility in every one of us, no matter what wounds we carry. Every one of us is a noble being. That's my book, Original Blessing, is about that. You know, I think the ideology of original sin that has been taught by Western religion, Western Christianity, since the 4th century, is truly debilitating. Each one of us, and we now know, science teaches us, has a billion-year history. And each one of us is noble. The universe has brought us forth and made us possible. And that only is not only about our dignity and nobility, but about our responsibility, too. We all have to take responsibility. And that's one thing I like about this book on the Christian mystics. It shows that what I'm talking about is not something I've invented in 2011. This is a lineage. This begins with Jesus. Well, really, it began long before him with his Jewish tradition. But in terms of the Christian label, it begins with Jesus and runs through many, many wonderful people whom I try to bring forth here with short quotes from their from their writings and with some commentary by me, and you realize, wow, we have ancestors. You know, we're not fighting this battle alone. We're part of a lineage. And then once Christians can get in touch with their lineage of their nobility, then we're in a place to understand the Buddhist lineage or the Native American lineage or the Sufi lineage or the Jewish lineage. Like the Dalai Lama says, the number one obstacle to interfaith is a bad relationship with your own faith tradition. And if Christians do not know their mystical tradition, which is their best tradition, what gives birth to prophetic action, then we're in no place to appreciate the wisdom of Buddhism or of Judaism or of Native American or of Sufi and so forth.
And that's what I like about this book in particular, because these are your roots. And
yeah,
you are being true as a true to the population of Christians who hear you. Because if you didn't have your roots and you didn't break all these bonds to speak your truth, it wouldn't have been as obvious what you're doing. Because, you know, you needed that start. You needed to come from a place that exploded through the norm, through this tradition, to create new, and then wakes everybody else up who is in that same tradition.
Well, thank you. That, I think that's well put. You're telling me what a great blessing it was that the Pope fired me.
Yes, that's true.
And it's been a blessing for some others, too.
Because it helps us.
I like that, because I believe in irony.
It also helps us witness you in so much purer way that we just are hungrier than to see what you're going to do next.
Well, it is. It does humanize me, I guess. You know, I'm not just a theologian sitting in an ivory tower with tenure, collecting a salary. I've never had tenure in my entire life. I've had a struggle with, as everyone else, and I've lost my job, like an awful lot of other people. You know, when the Pope did fire me, I became an Episcopalian because I wanted to work with young people to reinvent worship, to make it interesting again, to bring the body back. And so I was working with these young Anglicans from England who were bringing rave into the liturgy, and I found this to be extremely important and insightful. And so we've been doing that now here where I live in California for a number of years. We've put on about 90 of these masses, called them the Cosmic Mass, and we've trained others to do it, so they've been another parts of the country too. And I think the reinvention of our forms of worship is one of the most fun ways and profound ways that we can wake people up in a quick way. And this is the ancient way of teaching religion. It was elders teaching the young through ceremony and through ritual. And I think we need that kind of awakening today, and I think people are ready for it. And when you connect dancing and VJing and DJing and so forth to a liturgical tradition, there's no need for drugs. You get high without the drugs, and that's much cheaper, safer, and you can go to work the next morning.
Well, I think reading your book, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think reading your book gets you high too.
Thank you very much. Well, it got me high writing it, because being able to read these wonderful mystics and bring forth some of their insight was a joy for me. Certainly.
Well, I see that, because with each mystical writing in the book, there are 365 writings in the book, that it also has your commentary about it, so you can read it in the words of the original mystic, and then through your bringing it in more into current understanding.
Yes, and to remember, too, I mean, part of our mystical illiteracy is that we don't really understand, but the mystic in us, and every one of us is potentially a mystic, we were all mystics as children, our capacity to connect to the whole, this is what gives birth to the prophet in us, that is, to the social activist, and to the William Hocking, the American philosopher, said, the prophet is a mystic in action. And so the mysticism stirs up our love of life, And with that love of life, that passion that you talked about, then we're ready to defend and to work to make a saner world and a more just world and a healthier planet again, you see. So there's this wonderful feeding that comes, nurturing, that these mystics, all of them are also prophets. They stood up, they interfered with the church of their day or the culture of their day. A lot of them got in trouble, including 20th century ones like Teilhard de Chardin, Jesuit scientist and priest. He was forbidden to have his books published. They weren't published, most of them, until after he died. And so there are all kinds of wonderful people here who were activists as well as mystics, you see.
Right, and luckily you're getting your books out while you can still talk about them. And
well, thanks to radio programs like yours.
Good, good. And
I don't think Vatican Radio will be interviewing.
not for a while, anyway. So this book is so joyful to me because it's an awakening in the words of each mystic that brings you closer to your own truths and experience in life. And they find the joy. There are so many that lead you to the questions and the inner realizations, and also to talk about their experience of nature and of relationships, and you know, so many ways that we experience life that they saw the inner joy of, and the God of too.
Definitely, and the sacredness of everyday experiences, including our sexuality. This is something the church has not done a good job of. The church is so busy moralizing about sex that it's left out the whole dimension of the mystical experience of sexuality. How lovemaking, as told in the book in the Bible, the Song of Songs, lovemaking itself can be an experience of the divine, and a theophany. And this has not been celebrated by most preachers, and yet it's a deep part of our tradition, beginning in the Jewish Bible, but it's also present in a lot of Christian thinkers as well, but it's been kind of muted or covered up or edited out.
Well, this is also not only the joy of action, but it's also the joy of finding mindlessness and emptiness.
Yes, the joy of being, the joy of being. And I think science can really help us with this today. I mean, now we're learning that 97% of the matter in the universe is dark matter, which is not the kind of matter that we're made of, and that we see. And so we who are made of both light, because matter is frozen light, according to the physicist David Bohm, we are made of both light and matter. We're in flesh light. We're rare in the universe. So it's really very special what we're learning from science about the uniqueness of our being and the uniqueness of this earth with all of its diverse creatures and all, the beauty of it all. It's just almost overwhelming. It fills us with awe again. And so science is an ally. I don't understand these fundamentalists who think science is an obstacle. I think science is an ally because science exposes for us the truths of the world in which we live, of this creation and how special it is and how ancient it is and how it's expanding, it's growing, it's constantly giving birth. It's encouragement for all of us to get out of our couches, recover that passion, and do something with our passion.
Well,
given the few number of years we all have to live.
And actually, science is growing more and more into that. And the show that I had that aired last night was a physicist talking about the science of life force.
Mm. Wonderful.
And yet, we're in such early stages of understanding that once we can know how the mechanisms of life force energy, then we can bring everything together and use it more powerfully to expand our own energy fields and our own interrelationship of how we share energy with each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly been my experience that there are more scientists who are mystics today than bishops. And so I think that we have an ally, and in Healthy Scientists, those who have not sold their soul to the Pentagon or to chemical corporations and so forth. So, I mean, a scientist is like anyone else. They're first of all a human being. And what projects they take on and what goals and whom they are serving, all these questions must be asked. Because, you know, obviously scientists can contribute to the destruction of the world as well as to its affirmation. And so scientists do have to kind of put their consciences into gear, as we all have to. And even bishops have to start putting their consciences into gear.
Right, and actually science is working on things that will change our theologies too, because there are a lot of scientists working on time travel right now, for instance, and teleportation.
Sure.
So
sure.
It's about understanding these multidimensional natures of our reality that give us even a greater sense of the beauty of our spirituality.
That's right, and of the depth of our consciousness. I mean, Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century said that every human being is capable of the universe. And now we're learning so much more about the universe, obviously, than they knew then, about how vast it is and how ancient it is and how it's growing and expanding and the beauty that's there. We're picking up pictures from Hubble Telescope and so forth, and how much activity is going on. You know, every 15 seconds, a new star is being born. You know, so the universe is a great maternity bed. It's constantly creating, and what an invitation that is for our species, because we too are very creative, to recreate education, recreate economics, recreate politics in the context of the real needs of the earth and of the of the global rubbing of elbows that we have with people of other religions and other races and so forth.
And
just learning, we all come from Africa, thanks to science we know that. That's incredible. It proves that really there are no races. We're one race, the human race, with interesting variations of color and shade.
We're running out of time. It is only a half hour show. So I want to come back to the purpose of the show is to get people to not only pick up Christian Mystics. Christian Mystics is a new book that you've published. And by the way, I want to repeat your name again, and I will in another minute or two. Matthew Fox, you're the author, and you've authored, this is your 28th book. People should not only pick up this book, they should go to your website, they should look at other books you've written, and hear your talks, and there's videos of you on YouTube. So there, it goes on, and you're getting bigger and bigger as technology increases.
Well, thank you for this interview. I appreciate people like you who are not only looking to those who are at the edge and taking some bruises for their teachings, but that you have a forum, a wonderful forum through radio, to put the word out there to much larger audiences. And that's a very noble vocation and profession that you're involved in. And
yes.
We're in this together.
Yeah, I'm very proud of it, and I'm also very proud that you're a guest on my show, and I'm very honored that you could talk with us, and I'm thankful for your Christian Mystics book, and I'm so glad to have it. It lit me up, and I'll continue to hold on to it, and I recommend it to my listeners.
Thank you, Peter.
And thank you so much for being on Energy Stew.
You bet. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And
bye now. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at Progressive Radio Network. And I can be reached at Peter at HeartRiver, HEART, river.org. And thank you so much for listening.